This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. I'm honored to have in the studio with me today James Yee, the former Army chaplain down at Guantanamo, who was falsely accused and falsely imprisoned for 76 days, almost all in isolation, in a military brig down in South Carolina. James Yee has now written about his ordeal in a book, a very gripping book, entitled For God and Country. James Yee, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's my pleasure and honor.
Why did you decide to write this book?
You know, a number of reasons. One, my story is an American story that has to be told, especially because it occurred during this post 9/11 era in which clearly our civil liberties are being eroded. And being a Muslim American, being a Chinese American, that net was casted out, and I was swooped up in it, and as you said, was wrongly and falsely accused of very heinous crimes, which you know we're going to talk about.
Crimes that were punishable by death if they had convicted you.
Right, they were accusing me of espionage, spying, aiding the enemy, mutiny and sedition. All of which are actually capital crimes, and they did. The military prosecutor did threaten me with the death penalty.
James, you give me a little bit about your background. You say you are a Muslim American, you are a Chinese American. Where did you grow up, and how did you become a Muslim American?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm actually a third-generation Chinese American. I'm a graduate of West Point, and I come from a family that's actually deeply rooted in the military. I have a younger brother who's also a graduate of West Point, the U.S. Military Academy. I have another younger brother who is serving on active duty today as an Army doctor. And my father, who was also born here in this country, served in World War II, being drafted during that time. So all of the men in my family have actually served the military, the armed forces, something we're all proud of, and an indication that the military culture has, for a long time now, been deeply rooted in my family history.
Did you always want to go to West Point and join the military?
You know, I went to West Point at the encouragement of my high school wrestling coach, who really, as I became the captain of the high school wrestling team, instilled in me the idea that West Point was the premier institution for, any of those who were looking to be leaders of the nation in the future. And this is where he directed me, and because he was such a mentor to me, followed his lead and ended up at West Point.
And was it while you were in the military that you converted?
It was actually shortly after I graduated West Point when I found myself involved in some very basic interfaith dialogue. You know, I was raised a Lutheran, one of the more liturgical Protestant denominations. And, after West Point, being involved in some interfaith dialogue, first time hearing anything really about Islam. And it was, you know, initially something I immediately rejected. But the challenge was put out to me. Well, how could I judge something that I knew nothing about? And that made sense. So I started learning about Islam. I did some self-study, really, so I can come back and re-engage in this dialogue, conversation, with more information. And it was interesting that I learned that much of what I believed is found in Islam. The virgin birth of Jesus Christ, the second coming of Christ, these are things that Muslims believe, things that I was taught to believe as a young Christian in the youth group, as well as the whole lineage of biblical prophets, from Abraham to Moses, David, Joseph, Noah and his ark. You know, these are biblical prophets that you also find in the traditions of Islam. And it was just a simple matter of also accepting that Jesus and Muhammad were also prophets that taught the same message that everyone else taught before them, that simply there's one God and that's who we should worship.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with James Yee, the chaplain from Guantanamo, who was falsely imprisoned for 76 days, and he's the author now of For God and Country. When did you decide then to become a chaplain in the Army?
Right. You know, I was a young Muslim as a young lieutenant in the United States Army back in 1991. I was deployed to the aftermath of the first Gulf, and it was interesting. During that time, I observed that the numbers of Muslims were increasing dramatically as a result of the thousands of soldiers that served in Saudi Arabia. Thousands of them converted. You know, there's reports that 5,000, perhaps 7,000 American GIs converted to Islam at that time. But during that particular period, there were no Muslim chaplains. And it was my, you know, questioning how could Muslims be properly represented if there were no Muslim chaplains within the ranks. And I thought that perhaps maybe one day I would come back and be the first Muslim chaplain. And so I left active duty after serving in the Air Defense Artillery, a Patriot fire control officer. Went and studied in the Middle East, studied under traditional Islamic scholars, learned a little bit of the Arabic language, and then came back in 2001 to be a Muslim chaplain. But
was that prior to 9/11?
Prior to 9/11, January 2001, I came back on active duty, but this time in the U.S. Army Chaplains Corps. And I wasn't the first Muslim chaplain, but I was one of the first.
And how soon after 9/11 did you realize things were going to get a little bit dicey?
Yeah, just 9 months later, 9/11 happened, the tragedies, the attacks on the World Trade Center, on the Pentagon, the United flight that went down in Pennsylvania. The Pentagon, senior levels of the leadership in the military, turned to me immediately to actually brief and talk about Islam to the troops, to the soldiers, to bridge the gap, to give understanding to soldiers and service members about Islam, the religion. The religion that I converted to and studied overseas. And I did that, getting lots of praise and recognition, and was doing a fine job and getting the praise from my chain of command. And that's how I end up getting handpicked to go to Guantanamo.
Yeah, you write in your book, James E. Forgotten Country, that you were at first, anyway, a poster child of a good Muslim. That would change later on in the eyes of the Army. After you'd been at Guantanamo for a bit, take me to Guantanamo and what were the conditions like when you got there?
Yeah, you know, great lead into this part of my experience. You know, at first when they sent me to Guantanamo to be the Muslim chaplain after we went into Afghanistan and started swiping up all these prisoners and putting them down in Guantanamo, you know, it was interesting. Every single one of those prisoners, and at that time there were over 660, every single one is a Muslim. And that's why they sent me down there. So I thought that I was just being assigned to this mission, this prison camp operation, so that our government, our Pentagon, could say, well, yes, you know, we got these Muslim prisoners here, but we also have a Muslim chaplain. And of course, that means we're being very sensitive to the religious needs of these prisoners. I thought it was a PR stunt or, you know, a public affairs ploy to get me down to Guantanamo. But when I got down there, I actually was an advisor to the command on this unique religious paradigm where, yes, every single one of those prisoners caged in these open-aired steel mesh cells is a Muslim. And I advised on how the religious aspects of these prisoners' daily routine affected the detention operation. But on the second hand, I was also a chaplain to these prisoners. And as any military chaplain who serves the ranks of our armed forces, our priority is to defend the First Amendment right to religious freedom, to advocate for what we call the free exercise of worship. So I was down there to ensure that these prisoners, no matter what the government called them, hardcore terrorists or the worst or whatever, had the ability to practice their religion, Islam, and perform their prayers, observe Ramadan and whatnot.
Now, did they have that freedom? You write in your book, James E., that Islam was used as a weapon in Guantanamo.
Right. I was able to ensure some of those religious rights on a basic level. But then when we look at the process of detention and the process of the interrogation operation that occurs down in Guantanamo, I do. I write about something which I call Gitmo's secret weapon. Gitmo's secret weapon. And what was it? From my vantage point as a military chaplain, it was the use of religion against these prisoners. It was the use of Islam against these Muslim prisoners.
How did they use it?
In order to try and break them in the interrogations. Prisoners would tell me that when they were taken to interrogation, of course, they're shackled in the most extreme way at the wrist and at the waist and at the ankles. And sometimes these prisoners said they were forced to sit in the center of what was painted on the floor, a satanic circle, the satanic pentagram on the floor. And these interrogators would attempt to force these prisoners, these Muslim prisoners, to bow down and prostrate, like in the form of the Muslim prayer, in the center of this satanic circle, while the interrogator screams at that prisoner, that Satan is your God now, not Allah. You know, that's just one example. But there are many other ways, like desecrating the Quran, abusing the holy words of God, the Quran, which is held in high esteem and respect by all Muslims all over the world. Consider the little words of God was thrown on the floor, trashed during cell searches, in interrogation rooms, stepped on, kicked across the room.
Now, there were two allegations that appeared in the U.S. press. One was in Newsweek that a Quran was flushed down the toilet. Another was that a guard urinated on the Quran. Do you have any evidence about either of those?
The command investigation down in Guantanamo into the abuses towards the Quran has confirmed that, yes, a guard urinated on the Quran down in Guantanamo. That's confirmed. But I think the main point here is the Quran was being desecrated in very vile ways. That's confirmed. That's without a doubt happened down there.
And the detainees told you about that repeatedly?
Not only did they tell me about it, but I also witnessed incidences in where the Quran was abused and desecrated, when guards conducting their searches of the cells would tear the pages out and rip the bindings and whatnot. This happened also in front of the prisoners. All the cells are open-aired cells, and they can see what's happening. This led to massive riots and disturbances on the part of the prisoners, who were protesting adamantly about how the Holy Quran was being abused.
I'm speaking with James Yee, who was chaplain for the army down at Guantanamo and then falsely imprisoned for 76 days. He writes about the whole thing in an incredible new book called For God in Country. Did you witness other mistreatment not related to the Quran of the detainees?
Yeah, there was even physical abuses that was going on down there. One of the things that I saw the actual bruises on the biceps of the prisoners for when they get their hands shackled through the slot in the door. After their hands are shackled, sometimes the guards would yank on those chains, pulling their arms through that slot in the door, bruising their upper arms. I saw the actual bruises on these prisoners. But I also saw the consequence of one incident in which a guard actually was able to get out of his cell, actually tried to trap three of the guards in an open cell that they were searching. But, you know, he was easily manhandled by the four guards on the cell block.
This detainee got out of his cell.
Yeah, he was put in his cell. Somehow the guard neglected to lock the cell door. Whether it was intentionally or by accident, depends on whose side of the story you listen to. But anyway, he came out of his cell. He attempted to lock the three guards who were searching the empty cell adjacent to his in that cell. But the three guards and the fourth guard who was down the corridor, all of who were over 200 pounds, were no match for that one single prisoner. They easily manhandled him, threw him down to the ground, face down, cuffed his hands behind his back, cuffed his ankles. The incident should have stopped there, but it didn't. One of the guards went further and bludgeoned the back of that prisoner's head with a heavy handheld military steel radio. There was blood everywhere.
Did anything happen to that guard?
I write about even that pool of blood that I saw when I came, that there were even perhaps chunks of flesh in that blood from that prisoner's head. I witnessed how the prisoners were all in a state of shock after they witnessed what happened to that prisoner. And the guards themselves were severely shaken because the three guards essentially had to pull their colleague off the back of that prisoner to keep him from killing that prisoner. I don't know if he was ever disciplined, but clearly this was something which we call in the military an excessive use of force. The threat was nullified, but excessive force was continued to be applied, violating what we call the rules of engagement.
Well, there's also the Geneva Conventions, James Yee, and George W. Bush said the Geneva Conventions don't apply down at Guantanamo Bay. And you write about that in your book, For God in Country, that the Bush order had a statement that the United States would treat detainees humanely to the extent allowed by military necessity. And you said that last phrase was was almost a joke down there practically.
Yeah, it's a phrase that was included in the policies down there when we wrote the standard operating procedures that, you know, it opened the door to any exception which they considered necessary just because of military necessity. And that could mean anything. Anything they wanted to do, they can consider an exception if it violated Geneva Conventions. That was the situation down there. The Geneva Convention simply did not apply, and to this day, basically, it's the same. The interpretation is that the Geneva Conventions really do not apply to detainees down in Guantanamo.
Do you believe detainees were being tortured there?
Definitely cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment without a doubt was occurring down there, and I have no doubt that Senator McCain had Guantanamo Bay, Cuba in mind when he drafted his anti-torture legislation, because he includes in it that cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment would be banned for any prisoner that's held in U.S. custody, regardless of nationality and regardless of location. So I know he had Guantanamo Bay, Cuba in mind when he wrote this legislation.
Now, tell me, James Yee, about how you got to be imprisoned and falsely imprisoned. You write that before you left Guantanamo, when you thought you were going home on a visit, correct, that you knew some other U.S. soldiers who were Muslim Americans were under suspicion. Did you feel that you yourself were under suspicion?
All of the Muslim personnel who were working down in Guantanamo, the patriotic American personnel, patriotic American Muslims, who were fulfilling the roles of translators, myself as a chaplain and whatnot, were all under some type of suspicion down in Guantanamo. There was this incredible anti-Muslim hostility down in Guantanamo that was directed not only towards the Muslim prisoners, but also towards the American Muslims who were serving this joint task force. We all felt it, and several of us were under official investigation. I wasn't the only one who actually ended up being jailed. There were at least two others who were jailed also. But, you know, I've always been someone with confidence in myself to be able to explain Islam effectively to others and explain who I am and what my role is, and to educate others about Islam, the true understanding of Islam, the religion that I converted to, and did very well and was praised for that even by the military.
You got a great write-up evaluation just a couple days before you left the island, just a couple days before you were detained. Mm-hmm. Take me on that flight out of Guantanamo to Florida, and then what happened?
Yeah, after receiving official military awards down in Guantanamo for my contributions, after receiving the best officer evaluation report that I had ever received in my entire military career, I went on what I thought would be a short two-week break. Landed back in the United States at Jacksonville Naval Air Station. When I landed, the customs officials stopped me and they searched my bags, thinking that it was seemingly quite possibly a routine customs inspection. But that's not what it was. I learned later the FBI was involved. They had contacted the customs agents even as early as a day before my arrival and again that morning of my arrival. They instructed the customs officials to single me out, identify me before I even step off the plane, and then have my bag searched. So this was not just a routine search. This was now a search being conducted by an extension of a law enforcement agency, the FBI, without probable cause, a violation of my Fourth Amendment right to be free from an illegal search and seizure.
But they also violated your Sixth Amendment right to an attorney. Didn't you ask to talk to an attorney and they wouldn't let you?
I didn't actually get to see an attorney until days later when they were ready to put me in what we call a pretrial confinement hearing. You know, throughout the whole ordeal, a number of my constitutional rights were trumped. But really, the conditions under in which they held me and how they treated me, very, very much similar to how they treat detainees down in Guantanamo, was what was most frightening.
Did you ever fear for your life?
Without a doubt. It became very scary after a point. At first, I thought it was just ridiculous that they were accusing me of what they said, having possession of suspicious and then classified documents. I thought it was ridiculous when they got an arrest warrant and then actually put me in jail that very same night. But it got scary when they decided to move me to a super maximum security naval brig down in Charleston, South Carolina, and in the manner in which they moved me there. They threw me in the back of this truck with an armed guard. There were two other armed guards in the front. I was shackled at the wrist and at the waist and at the ankles. just like prisoners down in Guantanamo are shackled. And then the guard takes out of this bag these goggles. They're painted black, opaque, puts them on my eyes, so now I can't see anything. He then takes out these heavy industrial-type ear muffs and puts them on my ears, so now I can't hear anything. I can't see anything, I can't hear anything, and I'm shackled like a prisoner down in Guantanamo. This is a tactic which we call sensory deprivation. It's used to instill fear, intimidation, and confusion. I knew about this tactic because that's, of course, how I observed the prisoners down at Gitmo being treated when they're flown in from Afghanistan in process down at Guantanamo.
That must have been haunting. James Yee. James Yee is the author of a book, For God and Country. He is the man who was chaplain down at Guantanamo and was falsely imprisoned, as he's telling us. This is Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. Tell me about the conditions in the brig once they got you there.
As they transported me under this sensory deprivation, this is when I really was fearing for my life, especially in my interactions with prisoners down in Guantanamo, who told me how they were kicked and beaten violently in their transport to Guantanamo. And I didn't know what was happening to me. I knew that they were treating me just like an enemy combatant and maybe would never show up somewhere again. But when they put me in the cell, I was at least relieved that I was alive. One of the most ironic things about the whole situation in that cell was, being a Muslim chaplain down in Guantanamo, I was able to defend some of the religious rights of the prisoners, like ensuring the call to prayer was made five times a day, getting an arrow painted in every cell, facilitating the directional prayer for the Muslims, adjusting meal schedules during Ramadan to observe the fasting. But all of this stuff was taken from me as a U.S. citizen under U.S. military custody. They refused to give me the prayer times. They refused to even give me the direction to the northeast, which is towards Mecca from North America. They refused to even allow me to see a clock. So my religious rights were trumped. The same religious rights that I was able to protect for who they call suspected Al-Qaeda and Taliban prisoners down in Guantanamo.
James E., what effect did your imprisonment have on your family while you were down there?
The entire ordeal was utterly traumatizing, emotionally, psychologically, mentally, for everyone in my family, especially my wife, who we got married in Syria, where I met her when I was overseas studying. You could understand a little bit that someone who comes from a country like Syria, when the FBI comes knocking at your door in those countries in the Middle East, that when the federal intelligence agencies come to your door, that's a sign that you may never be seen again. This is what was the fear that was going through my wife when they came to interrogate her after I disappeared and her not knowing where I was. This was traumatizing in every way.
You write in this book, For God and Country, James Yee, that there came a time when your wife became despondent, and this must have been especially harrowing for you. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, there was at one point when I had just been released from prison, and she was at the edge of suicide, perhaps. I was released. I had been charged with mishandling classified documents. I had been accused of these heinous capital crimes, been threatened with the death penalty. And then as they let me out of prison, not charging me with these heinous crimes, they tried to ruin my reputation and then attempted to smear me by then saying that I had committed adultery or had pornography on a government computer. All of this together, again, was an enormous weight on the shoulders of my wife, and it drove her to the edge in which she was ready to end it, just from, you know, the tarnishing of her family's reputation, from the culture that, you know, she comes from, being a Palestinian, from me being accused of the worst terrorist crimes in this country and being accused of treason. It was an enormous weight, and she was ready, looking for a way to end the pain.
Yes, you tell in For God and Country, James E., that she had found your a pistol and had called you up and asked how to use it, and you thought she might be using it against herself. All these violations of your rights as an American citizen, are you considering suing the government?
You know, that's been asked of me before, but I find myself in a very difficult position where I could effectively sue the military because of how they treated me. I've learned that there's a doctrine called the Ferries Doctrine, which actually prevents people in the military from suing the government, from suing the military. And that's been upheld a number of times by the Supreme Court. And I've been told that this would apply in my case since everything happened to me while I was in the military, and the case would probably just get thrown out of court. But I am fighting for an official apology because I truly believe what happened to me was a gross miscarriage of justice. I think the people that made the decisions to imprison me, to bring charges against me, to falsely accuse me should be held accountable. All they've done is undermine the entire U.S. military justice system. They've undermined the current administration's attempt to hold prisoners down in Guantanamo accountable under U.S. military justice system when me as a U.S. citizen completely gets a raw deal.
Well, James E., what hope do you have of obtaining that apology? What leverage do you have?
I've had some significant support from members in Congress and from senators who have helped get behind me. And we've actually been able to get the Department of Defense Inspector General under Rumsfeld to open an investigation into the mishandling of my case. And I believe that when that's completed, it will show that some severe mistakes were made. And I believe that could very well lead to an apology. I want to continue to be an eternal optimist in thinking that people in our government will do the right thing.
James E., what do you make of the recent law, Military Commissions Act? What is that going to do for our rights here as U.S. citizens, or for people who aren't U.S. citizens, for their rights?
Yeah, the new Military Commissions Act that was signed into law by our president, it's very disturbing. And from this point of view, the point of view of a chaplain who dealt with many of the family members and dependents of U.S. service members, the Military Commissions Act is not fair to the families who lost people at 9/11. These families who lost loved ones from the tragic attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania on United 93 are waiting for justice. They're looking for those people who committed these acts to be held accountable. But this legislation will only prolong that justice. It's eventually going to go back to the Supreme Court, and that'll take years to determine whether or not it's permissible for the president to strip habeas rights from prisoners, the ability to contest unlawful detention in U.S. courts. That's going to take more years and waiting. And it's not fair to those families who lost loved ones on 9/11.
James E., what are current conditions like down in Guantanamo? Do you know?
You know, I was removed involuntarily from that Joint Task Force operation back in 2003. And that's almost 3 years now. And but I'll still say that there are some indications that things haven't gotten any better. Like, for example, the three suicides that occurred this past summer. Three prisoners actually were successful in killing themselves because I believe they couldn't take the conditions any longer. The hunger strikes that have been going on down in Guantanamo have gotten up to 130 people. Some of them were being force-fed just to be kept alive. I mean, this is an indication that the situation is still dire. The indefiniteness of the detention without charges, the lack of due process, this is having an incredible toll on the prisoner's mentality and psyche.
That's going to have to be the last word. James E., thanks so much for being my guest today. James E.'s book, again, is For God in Country. You can find out more by going to justiceforye.com.
Thanks.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.